We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
All right, we are here with the story man himself, Neil Schusterman. Welcome to the channel. Appreciate you taking out some time. I like to ask every author, what is your supervillain origin story?
My supervillain origin story. I got interested in writing when I was young, when I was in high school. But it was really when I was in college, the summer between my years at college, that I worked as a counselor at a summer camp. And I got to be known as the camp storyteller, and I ended up coming up with stories to tell, and the kids liked them, and they always told me you should write those stories into books. So I would go back the next summer, having written one of the stories into a novel that I would give out to them, and then I try to get those novels published, and the first two never sold, but the third one did. And so I've been doing it ever since.
Yeah, I think it's a rare thing when the first one does sell, but
yeah.
It brings
and
me
sometimes
to
not question. Even not even a good thing, because if the first one sells, you think you've arrived when you still have a lot of craft yet to learn.
True. I do have to ask you, and this is an off-topic question, but how long ago did you snag yourself storyman.com? Because anybody who tries to create a website these days or a handle, finding a good name that's not already in use is so difficult.
When I first heard of the internet, either it was the late 80s or early 90s, when nobody knew what it was, and this whole idea of domains, and that I just had this sense this was going to be something huge. And so years before I even had a website, I snagged storyman.com. And it was a good bet.
No, it was a great bet. Trust me, if I had started a little sooner, I'd probably be something a little bit easier to pronounce than Griftkin, but you know, but that's what I ended up going with. Another question I like to ask for any aspiring authors out there. If you had one piece of advice that either you wished you had gotten earlier or you would give to a new author just starting out, doesn't have to be writing advice, just author advice, what would you tell them?
A bit of advice that I would give, just life advice and author advice, is live outside of your comfort zone. The things that you learn outside of your comfort zone goes into who you are as a human and as a writer. I've always found that all those experiences that I was afraid to do, but I did anyway, those are the things that have changed me as a person and have helped me grow as a writer.
Easier said than done. It's called outside of your comfort zone for a reason. All right. So especially when it comes to writing, obviously I know you get to a certain size and you probably didn't realize it's like, oh, you know, I get to write, but then I also have to market and do interviews and go on book tours and stuff like that. But when it comes to just the act of writing, what does a day in the life of Neil Schusterman?
Well, you know, there are some writers that have their set time. And my friend Jonathan Mayberry, he says he has to write 2,000 words first thing in the morning. He doesn't do anything until he gets his 2,000 words written. I can't do that. It tends to come in fits and starts. Most of my writing gets done away from home. People talk about having to have their writing space and their comfortable space to write. It doesn't work for me. You know, my home office is where I do taxes. I don't get any writing done there. My writing ends up being done while I'm in a plane, while I'm on a train, when I'm I'll go out to the beach. Yeah, anywhere I can go that sort of takes me away from my home environment is always much more conducive. And so I don't have a typical writing day, but when I am in the zone, which is usually while I'm traveling, I will spend hours just focusing on a story, something that I'm working on. I'm usually better in the morning and afternoon than evening. I'm not an evening person. I know there's lots of people who talk about having a full-time job all day and then spending the evening writing. After 5 or 6, my brain will not function enough to be able to get inside my own head enough to write. So I always have to use those daylight hours and those early hours as my time for writing. And if I miss that, if something happens and I'm too busy doing something else, or if I have a speaking gig during the day, then that's the day that I'm not going to get any writing.
Gotcha. All right. Before I forget, I do have to ask you one question, because I ask my And let me just start by this. Obviously, I've read, I just brain dumped the first book of Scythe.
Scythe.
Yeah, just Scythe. I'm trying to make it harder than it is. I've read Scythe, I've read Unwind, but my gateway drug to Neil Schusterman, I used to read the books that my kids would read when they were younger, just so that I would know what they were reading as a parent. And my daughter introduced me to a book called Duckling Ugly. So Dark Fusion is my gateway drug to Neil Schusterman. And she knew I was talking to you tonight. So I asked her if she had any questions for you. And her question was, why does he like to hurt?
So that I can make you feel better in the end. Yeah.
I had to share that with her. I mean, I'm sure she said that as a joke, but she's in her late 20s. So yeah, it's like we've been reading you in this household for a long time. That's my actually one question I do want to ask you. Obviously, I know you're working on the prequel for Scythe right now. Do you ever see yourself maybe dipping your toe back into the Dark Fusion universe?
You know, I had other ideas for Dark Fusion. I had the whole idea behind Dark Fusion was to take a fairy tale and cross it with a myth or a legend that had nothing to do with that fairy tale and sort of come up with something new. So Duckling Ugly is like the Fountain of Youth crossed with the ugly duckling fairy tale. Dreadlocks was Medusa crossed with Goldilocks. And I had a whole bunch of others. I had a Hansel and Gretel one. I had a Jack and the Beanstalk one. But that series, there were three books in that series. And I moved on from there. There were other projects that I was more excited about writing, that the publisher was more excited about. And sometimes it comes down to a business decision rather than a creative decision. I mean, there's a lot of things that I can write and a lot of things that I'm excited about writing. But, you know, how do I pick which one is going to get my attention? I mean, if there's something that I'm just so passionate about that nothing else matters, regardless, that's going to get written. But if it's one of many ideas that I'm excited about, the ones that end up getting the attention are the ones that seem to make the most sense to write.
And obviously, anybody who's looking for a new Neil Schusterman book, MindWorks just came out last week. So love this. It is basically a collection of four collections, isn't it? You've had collections of these short stories before, and now this is it all together plus a couple extras.
Yeah, it's a collection. It takes most of the stories from my Mind Quakes, Mind Benders, Mind Twisters, and Mind Storm story collections. But in addition to that, there are about a dozen stories that were written for other authors' anthologies and various different other publications. And so they're all gathered together into this one volume, along with a few new stories.
Yeah, I know you had a Scythe one in here. I also like the interview little thing you did at the end. I won't tell anybody what the interview is. Go read it yourself. That was a fun little dip into the universe, including you basically putting yourselves in the heads of some of your
characters. Yeah, I got a little meta there. And the interview included one of my characters interviewing me.
Yeah.
And basically asking me, why do you like to hurt me?
Yeah, that was my question my daughter had. So that's why I thought that was kind of funny. That was spot on. And then I don't want to get their names wrong. I loved the interplay between Faraday and Goddard as well on that one. That was hilarious.
It was a lot of fun to write that and to sort of, just, you know, I do have a bit of a background in playwriting. And so it was kind of fun to create this sort of little play between.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I love how they're snarky, especially Goddard. Snarky.
No, Goddard. Yeah, totally interviewer. Snarky.
I do have to say, obviously, every section in this, and it's split up into sections, so they're kind of like topics are grouped together. And I liked a lot of the ones from every one of them, but the main section that I ended up falling in love with, the living, the dead, and the undecided, there were so many stories in there where it's like, okay, that was a good short story, but I would almost like to see a novella, at least, in this universe. You had some really, really interesting short stories in there.
There were a lot of stories that I would love to expand on. You know, I mean, usually when I'm writing a short story, I'm exploring a new voice or a concept that I don't quite know what to do with. And so I'll explore it with a short story. Sort of, you know, short stories are my laboratory for exploring various new things. And a number of them just sometimes feel like I want to go further with them. But again, it's that how much time do I have and where. And I have to decide where my time goes. But yeah, the different sections. And when I looked at all the stories, I noticed that they kind of all fell into these different categories. And so it was fun trying to figure out which category each story went into.
Yeah, I won't give anything away because it's a very, very short story, but I don't think I've ever seen such a creepy retelling of a moment in time of a pencil.
Yes.
That one was so, it was like, where is he going with this before I finally figured out what you were doing?
Yeah, it sounds pretty horrific until you realize exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the point of that story. And that was, in terms of experiments, that was the first time I had written a story from the point of view of an inanimate object, personifying an inanimate object. That has come back several times. So, you know, from that story, I learned how to sort of do that. And that came back in another story called Presumed Destroyed, which was a story about a school shooter or the events leading up to a school shooting, but all told from the point of view of the weapon that the kid was going to use. And yeah, that is one of my favorite of all the stories.
Was that in here, or did you have another one along the same lines? Because that sounds very familiar.
No, that is in Mind Works.
Okay, yeah. I know what you're talking about.
I wrote that with my son, Brendan.
Yes, he had a couple of them there.
One of the most powerful stories I think I've ever
heard. Yeah, it was interesting. I was waiting to see where that went. And I think you do this very well, but one of the real sparks of a short story is knowing exactly where to stop and you don't get to see the rest. That's just in your head. And I think you can do that with a short story that you can't do with a novel.
Yeah, there are sometimes I try to do that in novels. I try to put the ending that is ambiguous, but ambiguous intentionally, that the ambiguity is part of the story. But it's easier to do that with a short.
I think it's easier to do without your fans pulling out pitchforks. I think Yes. They expect it in a short story, but when they see it in a novel, they're like, hey, I need book two.
I think my favorite ending of anything that I've ever seen is the ending of Inception. And I'm always trying to capture that moment, that feeling you had at the moment that movie ended.
Yeah, yeah. I've definitely read a lot of short stories or novellas, especially. That especially in horror, and I think you touch a horror a lot, even for somebody who writes YA. I think you've got that germ of horror in your background going, and I feel like those really lend themselves to that ambiguous ending and like what happens next.
Well, I think even the story that you mentioned from Dark Fusion, Duckling Ugly, has that ending that where it feels like you want to know what happens the moment after the story ends. You want to know where it's going, and I think it's part of world building. You know, and when you build a world, you want that world to feel full and complete. You want it to feel as if it existed before the story started and will exist after the story ends. That this is just a slice of life within that world and within those characters' lives. So, you know, when I there's always people who want sequels to all of my books, even this, you know, the standalone ones that everybody talks about wanting sequels. And I always ask them, well, if I wrote a sequel to, say, Full Tilt, I wouldn't have written Unwind. You know, if I wrote a sequel to Dry, then we would never have gotten, any of the books after that. Although I have to say that my son Jared and I are planning a companion book for Dry that's going to deal with Hurricane.
Interesting. Yeah, Unwind, that was the one, I think, because obviously, I fell in love with you with the Dark Fusion series. Unwind was the one, though, I think that really made me think more than some of the other books did. That one was deep, that whole series.
When I wrote Unwind, I didn't know if anybody was going to read it because, the elevator pitch is it's a dystopian world where teenagers that don't contribute to society can be used for their body, which on the surface sounds horror, but I always try to play against that. I always try to look a little deeper than that. You know, horror stories are designed to scare you, and I never write stories to scare you. I do write stories that might disturb you, but the point of it is to make you think, is to sort of shake you up enough to look at things from a new point of view. The thing that got me to write Unwind was the idea that if 100% of you is transplanted to other people, what happens to your consciousness? Who are you? Where is your soul if your body is alive but divided? And the fact that that question has no answer, and yet they're saying that within our lifetimes, they're going to be able to use 100% of a donated body in transplant, it poses a question of what does it mean to be alive? Where does our consciousness reside? I felt that was a question really worth putting forth. I don't put forth answers. I just put forth questions.
I mean, you need to ask these questions. Also, I'm not sure I use 100% of the body I've got. So, you know, hey, whatever. Oh man, the downside of short story collection is like there's so many stories in here that I can't. You almost can't ask anything about because the way you write, there's always that twist, and I don't.
Yeah, it gives it away.
Anything. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this question. Obviously, first of all, tell people pick up the book, and I'm not just saying that because Neil's on here. This book had. There's going to be something in here that you're going to like. There's so many different groups, and like I said, he split it up by different sections. So you're probably going to like some more than the others, but there's something in here for everyone. Is there any short story in here, not counting the Scythe one, is there any short story that you think, you know, I might like revisiting this world or fleshing this out sometime?
There are so many stories in Mind Works that I would love to in various different mediums. I mean, there's a story, Dawn Termin, which is a story about the sun goes nova, and basically the entire sunlit of the side of the world was burned away. And for the people on the dark side, they just have a few hours until the earth rotates into the burning rays of the sun to figure out what they're going to do, how they're going to survive. It's a very short story. I mean, it's about 7 or 8 pages, but Netflix is now turning that into a movie.
Wow.
And I'm excited to see what they do with it. I'm not as involved with it. I'm sort of standing back because I've been focusing more on the TV series of Scythe, which is in development now. But there are other stories. There's the opening story, which is about a presidential election. That's a new story that was written during the latest presidential election. And I think everybody who reads it will get a real kick out of it. Can't say very much about it and what goes on in it, but because it gives away the secret. But that is a story that I would love to do something with.
That's probably the one story in there too that I read and I'm thinking, what am I reading? It's like a page or two in, I started to go, okay, I see where he's going with this, but I need more information because I don't know how he's going with this. But that was, yeah, that was a fun one. I really loved, and the one I would love seeing turned into maybe even a mini series if they could do something good with it. Resurrection Bay.
Yes.
That one was so good.
Thank you. That's a story that was never published physically. It was only, that was a digital story that I did with HarperCollins. And I wanted to get it into a collection. I mean, it's about a glacier, the soul of a glacier inhabiting the dead in Alaska. And that is one that I would like to see done as a movie or a miniseries.
It gave me certain vibes, but I'm not going to say that here for people who haven't read it yet because I don't want to give away the big part at the end. I'll tell you that afterwards. But yeah, that one was, again, that was like, if I had to pick a favorite, that one might be it. It was
great. So thank you.
And like I said, that whole section, this is almost 600 pages, by the way, anybody, but like you have so many short stories in here. So this, I obviously wanted to get this read before I talked to you today, so I had a time limit. But this is also a great book just to have somewhere with a bookmark in it. And it's like, you know, I got 15 minutes. I don't have time to read a chapter to this. I can read one of these short stories. I didn't count them, but there's a lot of short stories in here.
There are 43. There are 43 short stories.
43, yeah.
And some of them not that. Some of them very short. There's one that's a single page short story.
Yeah.
And there are some that are more like novellas. So it's
true. But on average, we're less than 20 pages though. So it's pretty short.
Most of them. I mean, I think the Scythe one is getting close to 50. And I think that there's one more that's pretty.
Yeah, two of the other ones in the Dead Letter and Loveless were another couple of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I was just drawn to you. I mean, I read all of them.
That's in the Living Dead and Undecided section. All of those.
Oh man, so much fun. Great. I mean, this is another one too, that you could read this, like save that section for, you know, spooky season if you want and read the rest now.
There are a number of funny ones in there too, because, you know, every once in a while I get punchy and want to write a humorous story.
Yeah. Even me too. Dead Letter still had a bit of that humor to it though. There was a lot of, as I like to call, snarkasm going on in that letter.
There's one called the Bob Squad, which is about a kid who sees his guardian angels. And what we find out is that everybody has 7 guardian angels that are constantly watching them, but we can't see them. But he dreams too vividly and suddenly they become visible to him. And now try to function with 7 people surrounding you at all times, giving you advice, telling you what to do, tripping you, messing things up for you.
Advice sometimes.
Yeah. I just listened to it on audio, and Greg Tremblay, who does the some of the, you know, there were multiple audio voices, but I love him because he does the Scythe books and he's just fantastic. And the way he did it, it almost had a Monty Python feel to it. And I loved it.
That's a good feel for it though, because yeah, that mm-hmm. one was, that one was way more humor than dark. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
Oh, and I just forgot the name of it. There was one in there too with the young girl with a pimple on her face, and she hated her face. That one was another little, I kind of saw where it was going, but that was another weird one.
Yeah, that's another story of switching souls and that type. There are a few stories like that in there.
Yeah, I think that was the last section. That wasn't the dead one. I don't think that was in the very last section. Is there anything, and I hate to do this because I usually love talking more about the book, but again, a lot of these short stories, I just don't want to give anything away. Is there anything you'd want to tell somebody about the book, maybe that we haven't specifically said, instead of touching on a specific story?
Well, I think that there's something in it for everybody. There's a science fiction. There's fantasy. There's a lot of Twilight Zone kind of feels to it, a lot of surreal type of things, and there's humor. So I think there's, regardless of the types of stories that you like, there is something in there.
Learned a lot of things in there. Be kind to your pencils. Don't touch statues in the middle of museums. You know, there's a lot of fun.
And beware of jacuzzi.
Yeah. I mean, nobody wants to see me in a jacuzzi anyhow, but that's off topic. My daughter did say one thing, and she told me that maybe I shouldn't tell you this, but where would the fun in that be? She said, maybe don't tell them that my dog Rogue is a little too much like Trixie.
So you got a super smart dog. Trixie is one of the stories in Gleaning. Yep. It's a story about a dog who is much, much smarter than her owner. And her owner happens to be a scythe. So it's that was a very fun story to write. I co-wrote it with my friend Mike Payne, and because he writes stories about animals, and so I brought him in to work on that one. But yeah, so this is MindWorks is all different stories, but I have other short story collections that are in specific worlds. There's Unbound, which is in the world of Unwind, and then Gleanings, which are stories within the world of Sight.
Right. So let me ask you a question, because I don't get a lot of authors on here that do it, but you've mentioned it a few times now. Is there a difficulty, or how much different is it to write a book when you're writing it with someone other than, this is my sandbox, nobody touch?
Well, it is different, and there are their own its own challenges working with a collaborator. I have been very lucky in that I've had really good collaborators. And the basic rule that I start every collaboration with, and it always seems to work, is that nothing goes into the story unless we both like it. And that is the prime directive. So nobody gets emotionally attached to anything until we know that the other person is on board with. And so there's never any argument. I've never had a situation where I've disagreed or argued with any of the collaborators I've worked with, because we have that rule in place. So without getting emotionally attached to something, we can say, okay, we'll come up with something better. And it always works.
Yeah, I just know, like, I'm sure fans are always, fans get upset, like, how could you have killed so-and-so? Like, how does that work when your collaborator is like, you can't kill so-and-so, I love that character.
If the collaborator says you can't kill so-and-so, then we don't kill so-and-so. It's off the table immediately without even further discussion.
So yeah, that's, you've got a whole lot of fans who want to collaborate now. So obviously we know that you've got the TV script going on the script going on for the Scythe world. And we know you've been working on the prequel. I've seen a lot of it, and you mentioned it on Instagram and stuff. What, if anything, can you tell us about the prequel?
The prequel, which is where most of my attention is going right now. Now I am not writing the script for the pilot for the Scythe series. The pilot is being written now. Director, writer attached, fantastic director and writer. And when they turn in the script, and hopefully when it gets green lit, then I'll be involved in writing the series. Then I'll be in the writer's room and I'll be involved with it. So I'm looking forward to that. But right now I am finishing up the first book in the prequel series. I'm not sure whether there's going to be a duology or a trilogy, but it's definitely not going to be just one book, because I just couldn't fit it all into one book. And what really got me interested about telling this story was I wanted to see the beginnings of the Scythedom. I mean, there's a lot of lore that I've set up and a lot of mythology as to how the Scythedom started and when we became immortal and all of that, and the Thunderhead, but I wanted to see it happen. What intrigued me most was the fact that in the world of Scythe, there's only one AI. What happened to Alexa? What happened to Siri? What happened to ChatGTP? They don't exist in the world of Scythe. And I realized if there's only one AI, that means that in a very Darwinian fashion, it basically was survival of the fittest. It devoured all the other AIs to become the Thunder. And then when it did, it realized that it killed off its kind and it was the only one left. I wanted to see that happen. I wanted to see it grow from a very small program that, you know, the way I thought of it is that it was a small program, an anti-malware program that went out to find malware and absorb it and destroy it, and eventually got so intelligent that it realized that every other program posed a danger, therefore everything other than itself was malware. So I wanted to see that happen. And the other aspect of the story was that I initially set up that there were a team of original Scythes. Who were they? And one of the things that I realized is that they were probably all teenagers who met on social media. And so I wanted to watch that
happen. That reminded me of your chat room story in here too. That was hilarious. But
talking about the idea of a laboratory to experiment with things, the chat room story, Mail Merge, is kind of a basis for the conversations that the characters have. Because they do meet in a chat room very much like that. And I intersperse that throughout the book.
I don't know why it is, but I just always love when I hear an author say that they're writing a book or they wrote a book because they either want to see how it ends or they want to see how it started. Like, they're not the ones making it out of whole cloth, but they need to put it on paper to see where the story goes. And I'm a nerd. I'm sorry. I just love that. I love that answer.
Oh, the characters take over the story. And once the characters do, it's not your story anymore. Then you're just, then you are just, you know, taking down their stuff. You're just, you know, a journalist taking down their story and telling, you know, through things through their eyes. It's, many times I just feel like I'm sitting back and just watching the story unfold. And yes, I'm creating it, but sometimes it doesn't feel
fair enough. Fair enough. I mean, let's face it, anybody who's ever written anything, and I'm not an author, I've written a couple of poems, those don't count. But it's that first line or that first stanza or that first thought. And that's what builds the rest of it that you had no clue of when you started. And that's not me talking to the fan. That's me talking to all you aspiring authors out there. Again, one of the reasons I ask a lot of authors the same question is so that we see the answers are different for everyone. But I also think there's a lot of authors like V. Schwab won't start writing something until she's outlined the entire book. I can't get my head around that. Other ones just have an idea and they sit down and just start writing and see where the story takes them. And neither one of them is wrong.
Yeah. And most of the authors that I speak to do a little bit of both.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, I outline a story beginning to end in absolute detail. And then once I feel confident that the story's done, then I'll start writing and I throw the outline.
Gotcha.
Because once the characters come to life, they never want to do what I plan for them to do. And anytime I try to force them to do something that they just wouldn't do as real people, then I feel like a puppet master. The characters no longer feel like real people. They just feel like they're being manipulated. So I automatically know that I'm going to throw away my outline at some point. Usually by the time I get to page 50, my outline is out the window. And once I see the directions that the characters are taking the story, then I'll stop and I'll re-outline based on the decisions that the characters are making. And I'll do that multiple times through the story.
And then you'll get to the editor, and then you've got other changes you need to make.
Yes. Although I have really good editors, and they are really good at seeing what I'm trying to do and helping me do it. I very rarely will have an editor who just throws a monkey wrench. But usually they'll say, you know, like with Roxy. Roxy is a story about, it's also a personified inanimate object. It's about drug addiction told from the point of view of the drugs as if they are the Greek god. These drugs that live in this rave, this party in the sky, and they come down to earth to mess with us. They can heal us, they can destroy us, and we never know what they're going to do. And my editor, who's also my publisher, Justin Chanda, suggested that we sort of structure it like a Greek tragedy. And think about how the gods are playing games with us, and you know, and really focusing on something that had already been in the story, but really he brought it out. He reminded us to focus on that and make that part of the structure of the story. So, you know, a good editor will see what you're trying to do and help you do it better.
Do you ever get a kick out of you write something and somebody takes it a certain way that maybe you didn't intend it, and you still think to yourself, I kind of like that. I didn't mean that, but I kind of like that.
That happens. That happens quite often, where they'll find something in there that either wasn't there or was there, but only subconsciously, that I didn't realize was there until somebody pointed it out. I mean, Scythe is a perfect example of that. After the book was published, one of my first events was a panel where the moderator asked, what was going on in your life when you came up with this? And I realized that I came up with Scythe during the year after my mom had a stroke, and we were put in a position of having to turn off her feeding tube and let her pass peacefully. And I had to do that, and you know, being there with my mother as she was passing. And then the next story that I write is a story about people whose job it is to end life with compassion. And I never made that connection until someone brought it to my attention. So many times writing is therapy, and sometimes you don't even realize what you're working through while you're writing.
No, I understand that. I'm sorry to hear about that, but yeah, I understand that. I do have to say, and I don't feel like this is giving too much away, I just want to make sure I get the name right. I do think you did Katrina a little wrong. I'm just going to put that out there. Everybody will have to read the book to know what that means.
The story Eye of the Storm was written before Katrina. And
No, I'm sorry. I meant the Scythe one, the girl Katrina.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. But no, that was a good one too, The Eye of the Storm. I saw that was the one with the statue. And I definitely kind of saw where that one was going, but I still loved it.
Oh, thank you.
It wasn't, I didn't have too many complaints, I have to say. This is pretty good. I think you even had one. I don't remember which one it was. I don't think it was the pencil one. I swear you had one in here that was maybe one page.
It was a one page. It's a Thanksgiving story.
Butterball. That's the one.
Yes. And you can't say anything about that story because it is just a one line gag. The entire story leads to the last line.
You wrote that entire short story just to give us a dad joke. That's all there is
to
it. Just
to give you a dad joke. Exactly.
That's the one where I read it and I was like, I almost kind of wished I hadn't read the title when I read it. Because I think it kind of puts you in that mind. But yeah. I know you got to name it something. Mm-hmm. All right. I know you got some stuff coming up after this too. And I'm not the only thing in your docket today. So if unless you got anything else to say about Mindworks, because that is the book that just came out. I was going to wrap up with a few questions I'd like to ask everybody. First and foremost, do you have a hobby, skill, accomplishment that you wish more people knew about so they talk to you about something besides books once in a while?
Funny you should ask, because right before this interview, I was taking some time to relax and focusing on my hobby, which is making stained glass.
Oh, nice.
And I am actually working on a piece that is the cover of Scythe, 18 inches by 24. And when I'm done with it, I'm going to put it up for a charity auction.
Oh, sweet. We'll have to keep an eye out for that one. Is there any questions that I didn't ask that you were expecting, or just something you wanted to talk about?
Oh, maybe a little bit about the book that came out earlier this year, All Better Now.
Okay.
Which is the first of a duology. And that's about a pandemic of joy where if anyone who catches this illness, when you recover, you're filled with lifelong contentment and not toxic positivity, not in a negative way, but actual legitimate contentment, the type of thing that we really do want in our lives. And so the question is, do we want to catch this? Do we want to spread it? And what happens when everyone in the world is suddenly content? What problems does that cause? Because our society isn't designed to function if everybody's happy, because who's going to buy all the crap they try to sell us if we're happy that we don't need it anymore? And how are politicians going to get their power if they can't make us angry? So there's a vested interest among the powers that be to find the cure for happiness. And that's the first of a duology. All Better Now is the first one. All Over Now, I'm going to write when I'm done with the second cycle.
That would be my next question. Yeah. It does remind me of the old customer service joke, though. We're not happy till you're not happy.
Until you're not happy, yeah.
All right. Final two, ask everybody this. I know your plate is full, but what, if anything, are you reading now?
What am I reading now? I am reading The Mercy of Gods by James A. Corey, who wrote The Expanse. It's part of it's a book that I'm reading for my book club, my book group. All of us, there's five of us in the group, and we were all the 2020 judges of the National Book Award for young people. And we love talking books so much that we stay together as a club. And now once a month, we read a different book, all from all different genres, because everybody has different tastes. And so that's the one I'm reading now.
Nice. Like that. And then last question, if you've got a shop at Amazon, I understand it, but I love my brick and mortar independent bookstores. Shout out to a brick and mortar of your choice.
Oh, there are so many. And it's like, I don't want to leave any out.
Three.
I mean, there's RJ Julia in Connecticut. There's Anderson's in the Chicago area. There's Blue Willow in Houston, Mysterious Galaxy in San Diego, Tattered Cover in Denver. There's so many great books. There's Kepler's in the Bay Area and Copperfield's. I love independent bookstores. And while, you know, of course I will do events at Barnes and Noble, and I always will try to squeeze in events at independent bookstores as well.
Yeah.
Because I mean, those brick and mortar bookstores are incredibly important. And, you know, I love the booksellers and all
that. Reminds me, I'm still a little upset at her. You were actually in Omaha you were getting an award, I think, for something. And you swung by the Bookworm to sign some copies on hand, and you met my daughter. And I was on vacation at the time, so I wasn't there. It's like, man, I could have met him. But yeah, no, she loved meeting you. So that's one of the reasons I reached out to her to see if she had any questions.
I'll stop at bookstores. I'll do guerrilla signings. I'll see an independent bookstore, and I will just go in and say, hey, I'm Neil Schusterman. I'd love to sign your books for you. And so I will just stop in bookstores and do that when I pass one when I'm traveling.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think you were, I can't remember if you were in Iowa or you were in Omaha at the time, but you just swung by and just signed some copies that were on hand. So we appreciated it. I just wished I'd been there. But I was on vacation with my wife, and she would have killed me if I skipped it. Just like, it's so close to being down. I can't go. All right. But yeah, I will get all of those links before I post this. I'll be posting this tomorrow. Get those all in there so people have links to those bookstores and to Neil's books, of course. Neil, I appreciate you. I've been wanting to have you on for a long time. Glad we finally got this to work together. And I will look forward to meeting you at some point somewhere. I just don't know where yet. Don't worry, I'm not stalking you. But if I catch you at a ReaderCon or a WorldCon, I am going to come up and say hi.
Okay, well, it's been great chatting, and thanks for having me.
All right, take care.